The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Dillis Powell, Dennis Norden, Ian Scott James, and Frank Muir. And here's the first round to try and test their respective vocabularies. 2 marks if they get the meaning of these words reasonably right. Dennis Powell, what do you understand by Armageddon?
I understand a word which I believe began in the Bible,
yep,
and signifies a general uproar of battle and massacre and death, and it was used in reference to the First World War.
2 marks it is. It's in the Apocalypse. It's in Revelation 16:16. It's the last great conflict between nations just immediately preceding the Day of Judgment. And then, metaphorically, it became the war-to-end war and any great final battle that happened. Dennis Norden, what is Slivovitz? S-L-I-V-O-V-I-T-Z. Slivovitz.
Well, it's a kind of East European answer to rocket propulsion. It's a kind of plum brandy, I think.
Yes,
something like that. And yeah, I know you one drink and you spend the rest of the evening searching for the top of your head.
Which particular countries do you go to?
Isn't it Yugoslavia?
Yes, that'll do. Absolutely fine. 2 marks it is. Plum brandy. It's made in Yugoslavia and Hungary. When I was in Czechoslovakia not long ago, they said they made it there too, so I hope that's true. 2 marks. Ian Scott James, what is a bravo? B-R-A-V-O. And I'm rather putting the accent on the first word so you don't get the obvious answer. A bravo.
Well, a sort of thug-type character who goes in for an adventurer.
Yes. Yes, you might even get worse than that, I think.
Well, a thug-type adventurer, you could hardly be worse than that, could you? A sort of...
They're generally hired, aren't they?
Yes, that's
hired,
right.
Bravo.
That's it.
Oh, a thug-type mercenary.
Yes, he might be a sort of
assassin.
That's it, exactly.
Rent
a
bravo.
Rent a bravo is absolutely dead right. 2 marks it is. It's a hired assassin or desperado, and comes from an Italian word. Frank, now, what is a philuminist? P-H-I-L-L-U-M-E-N-I-S-T. Philuminist.
One who, well, from the Greek, lights up love.
The other way around.
It's a policeman at night at Hyde Park with a torch.
Oh, Frank or Sonia.
It could be a chap who collects matchbox labels.
You're absolutely dead right. No, it is. 2 marks. This is an invented word, invented quite recently, I think. A student or collector of matchbox labels or covers, and it simply means a lover of light. 2 marks it is. Well, before we begin the second round, I give each team a quotation from to write down, and I want the 2 women members of the 2 teams to go on studying those quotations, because at the end of the program, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. And Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, your quotation is, "The best laid schemes of mice and men gang off to glee." And Ian Scott James and Dennis, yours is, "Your money or your life." And then at the end of the program, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. Well, now we have a round of who, why, where, and what questions. 2 marks again. Dillis Powell, who in what book said, 4 legs good, 2 legs bad?
The thing about that rabbit. No?
Rather larger than a rabbit.
Larger than a
horse.
Rabbit.
Horse.
A horse comes in, but go beyond the road to Wigan Pier.
Orwell,
yes.
Animal Farm.
Ah.
And what's he talking about?
Pig.
And why is he saying it?
Well, because he's the kind of Napoleon of the animal kingdom.
Yes. And what do you mean?
Better than humans.
Better than anybody.
Yeah, 1.5 then. This is George Orwell's Animal Farm, and as you remember, there's an animal takeover, and Napoleon is the boar or male pig who keeps on changing the party line just as it suits him, and he comes out with this phrase, which is bad for men, four legs good and two legs bad, and later on he changes it right round again, like some casuists do. 1.5. Dennis Norden, I think you probably know this one. I don't.
Well, that's a big change. Oh, yes.
What's the difference between a veteran car and a vintage car?
Oh, it's about 250 quid. Well, the difference is that one of them's older than the other.
Yes, that's true.
And
the veteran?
I think the veteran is older than the vintage.
Yes, quite.
Because it's a veteran car rally that they have once a year to Brighton.
Yes.
And they're incredibly old cars.
What sort of date?
It's about October the... I don't know. I really don't know. I should think, when did cars...
1905-ish.
Yes, it's got enough.
Beginning of this century.
That's good enough, yes.
And then vintage cars, I think, are sort of fairly elderly cars, which I only think of Hispano Suiza and things like that.
Well, you can't afford a new one, I think. It's
sort of Domford Yates type of
thing. Very much so. Would you like to bracket the decade in which they might have happened?
Well, 20s.
Late 20s and 30s, I think.
No, Anne's right now. I think you'll get her 2 marks. A veteran car is, by a term of art, a car built not later than the year 1904, whereas a vintage car is a car built between 1919 and 1930, when I did most of my motoring. Anne Scott James, what poet was prevented from finishing what poem by the unexpected and somewhat unwelcome arrival of a person from Porlock?
Come on, you do this. You know what I'm like on poetry.
This is, I don't know whether this is true or not. It's Kubla Khan.
Yes.
And Coleridge was supposed to have been writing it, and he's supposed to have dreamt the whole thing. The whole thing came to him entire and complete in the dream, and he was just scribbling it down when somebody knocked and said, "There's a person from Porlock to see you."
Yeah.
And somebody wrote a marvellous short story to say that there are actually people from Porlock whose sole function it is to interfere just when you're about to get on with something.
Well, before the town clerk from Porlock writes in to me, I'll give you 2 marks. It was Coleridge. In 1797, he'd been reading Purchas's Pilgrims, all about the Khan Kubla and the palace that he commanded to be built, and he fell asleep and woke up, as Dennis quite rightly says, with about 200 to 300 lines absolutely complete in his mind, and then this insufferable person turned up and stopped him in the middle of his writing, and he could never remember the rest since. So if you look at Kubla Khan, you'll find it's completely unfinished.
It's a marvellous situation to sort of fantasise that. You know, this man's coming and say, "Oh, are we right? Don't let me disturb you. I'll just take a drink. You get on. I'll just have a drink. Oh, you have done this place nice."
You must be exactly like that, Dennis.
Most writers, of course, welcome to disturb. You ring up a writer and say, "Is it all right? Am I disturbing you?" No!
Please do.
Getting on with it.
Well, poor Coleridge didn't. Frank Muir, in which novel by which author is the title extended by the words "a pure woman"?
Oh, Fanny Hill.
Well, not far wrong in concept.
Yes. Is it?
I don't know. Tess d'Urbeville.
Yeah. It was.
When Dennis is writing here, I think.
Yes. 2 marks. It's Tess of the D'Urbervilles by Thomas Hardy, written in 1891. And as a gesture of defiance, he put in the subtitle "A Pure Woman" because Tess is seduced in chapter 2, if I remember rightly. 2 marks.
Well, quite a way in.
Very slow going.
Well, now we have a round of nicknames, initials, and code names. I'm going to give them the names first and then ask for 2 marks for identification of whatever or whoever is really meant. Tillis Powell, ETA, all caps, and put dots between them if you like. ETA.
Electrical.
Estimated time of arrival. Wartime.
Yes, I'm good. Frank's quite right. 2 marks it is. Originally used, I think, by airmen, Frank, and still used, I think, by airline pilots when they think they're going to get in. Estimated time of arrival. Dennis Norden, the code names Tube Alloys and the Manhattan Project were the British and United States versions of the same thing. What did they stand for?
They were the same. I think I know the Manhattan Project, but I've never heard of tube alloy. Yes. The Manhattan Project was something to do with the development of the atom bomb.
Yes.
Very belligerent program, this. They're not the favourite. And I presume, what the heck do we call it, tube alloys? It's a genius who thinks up these things. The same bloke who calls these terrible hurricanes Edna. What's a gentle name?
Yeah. Well, kind of the same thing. So if you do the Manhattan Project, we're all right.
Oh, yeah. Then tube alloys. We called it tube. We didn't know what was going on. I'm sure. That was why.
That's all right. Yes, two marks.
You thought it was a desk they were building.
Yeah. Now, the British went in with the Americans into secret research and development of the atomic bomb, and we call it tube alloys, simply, I think, in order to try and deceive the Germans, and the Americans called it the Manhattan Project. Two marks. Anne Scott James, the Old Bailey.
It's a place of trial, I mean, where the High Court tries the murder cases and similar.
What's it called?
Well,
really?
I was a witness once at the Old Bailey, actually.
Well,
not in America.
Centre Court, was it? Centre Court.
One of the outside courts.
Lady Chadley trial.
Really?
Yes, it's very embarrassing.
Now, but remember what it's called when you were summoned to subpoena, or what it was?
I'm sure it was summoned to the Old Bailey.
The Nick.
I think it's called
the Criminal Court. Yes, sir. Is it something?
That's right.
The High Criminal Court or something.
One out of two. It's the Central
Criminal Court.
It's the London Central Criminal Court, and it's called that because it stood inside the ancient bailey of city wall. Frank Muir, Vinegar Joe.
Is a general, isn't it, during the war?
Do you remember what he was?
He was an American. Wasn't Patton. He was blood and guts.
That's right.
Was it Stillwell?
Yes, well done.
Vinegar Joe Stillwell.
Yeah.
It was in the Far East, wasn't it?
Well done. Two marks you get. I think that's jolly good.
Ian L. Flynn.
General Joseph W. Stillwell was the United States commander of Chiang Kai-shek's troops in Burma and I think in China during the Second World War. Now we come to the last round and go back to those two quotations I gave the teams earlier in the program. Two marks, Dillis Power, can you give them the origin of your quotation? The best laid schemes of mice and men gang off to glee.
It's from a poem by Robert Burns.
About what?
About a field mouse.
All right, that's good enough. You get your two marks. Robert Burns, to a mouse, I think, turned up by a plowshare, if I got this right. We sleek it carrying timorous beastie on what... I can't remember how it goes. On what a panic is I breasty. No, that's right. Anyway, Robert Burns and a poem on a field mouse.
There's an opera, the Defledermouse, isn't it?
That flies, that's right. Well, now, Anne Scott James, and the origin of yours, which was your money or your life.
Well, I think it would be a typical highwayman's threat when they galloped up to the carriage folk.
Yes, which particular highwayman?
Particular highwayman, I've only heard of one. That was Dick Turpin.
Right, good enough. Two marks, it's attributed to, though there's no real reason for knowing whether this is true or not, to the highwayman Dick Turpin, your money or your life, but a bit later it was also attributed to a writer, Samuel Butler, and he said, brigands demand your money or your life, women demand both. Well, now I'm going to ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanation of how these quotations came into being, and in this round the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. And so back to Frank Muir. The best laid schemes of mice and men gang oft aglee.
Terribly true, you know, when you think about it, that Scottish proverb. Quite recently, I was, one Saturday afternoon, I was shopping in Egham High Street, and I thought I'd take a short cut into the car park by nipping through the off-licence premises. And went down, nipped downstairs, and there's a back door into the car park. And the back door, for some reason, seemed to be closed that day. And the door closed behind me. And I found myself sort of imprisoned in this off-license storeroom. But I didn't panic or anything. I just kept very calm for a few minutes and took stock. my case comes up on Thursday. Now, there you have an example of trying to get home to my wife, and the fickle finger of fate puts a different twist to it. It isn't always to the bad, though. I told you some time ago the occasion when I sat on a soft-boiled egg, which I did quite simply. I put a tray with a soft-boiled egg on the chair, went to adjust the television set. It was something riveting on. I backed slowly in a crouched position, forgetting that the tray with the doily and the boiled egg in its cup was on the chair, and sat on it. And one of the curious things about nature is there's about a pint and a half of yolk in a soft-boiled egg. And it goes all over your trousers. Well, the following day, obviously, I had to take the suit to the cleaners. So I put it on a hanger, and I wasn't sure whether the bus was coming or not, and I leant rather far out over the pavement with this hanger, and the hook of the hanger caught on the wing mirror of a passing lorry. And the suit was bought. Luckily, I managed to catch sight of the name on the lorry, which was Jonas Brown of Helmsley, Yorkshire. They made aluminium French windows. I thought you'd like to know. So, of course, I had to get the train to Yorkshire that night. And I found this little firm that made these sliding aluminium French windows, and it was really rather a big firm. And the director was going off to London in his private aeroplane from the York airstrip, and he was taking my suit down, and he'd seen my name and address in the flap of the pocket. So he was going to take it down and get it sent from his London office. So I rushed to York. I won't bother you with getting to York Airport, but it was dark by the time I got there. And I went round York Airfield, flicking on my lighter, looking for his executive jet plane. But luckily, I was in luck, and I found it. But you know, when you're holding a lighter under an aeroplane, it's best not to hold it too... I set fire to the... Cut a long story short. I set fire to the aeroplane. He was really terribly decent about it. And I'm going to pay it off for an £8.15 a week until I'm aged 2040. But I was going to say, these things do turn out well, because when he gave me the suit back, it's a bit charred by that, when he gave me the suit back, I looked in the pockets, and there was a 10-bob note in the pocket. And do you realise that if, when I'd gone outside my home, if I hadn't leant forward to see whether the bus was coming and the lorry hadn't picked it up, I would have taken that to the dry cleaners, and that 10-bob note would have been ruined. And probably the best example of this sort of happenstance of fortune was over this little designer of China in Louis the XV's time in France, when they started up these works for making Sèvres for making China, and the Meissen works, which made usually vases, which are now known by collectors as Louis XV, and they opened a factory in Stuttgart, and the produce there is known to collectors as jelly cans. But there was a designer who wanted to make figurines for the court, and he wanted to have a whole orchestra of beautiful people playing instruments in beautiful porcelain, and this was his scheme to do this, but unfortunately he used his family as models, and he was an ugly man, and his family were even uglier. And when the figures came out, they were so awful. They looked like apes, like monkeys, these figures. Just by luck, somebody said, let's call them monkeys. And of course, you now know the monkey orchestras are one of the most famous pieces of China in the world today, just through chance. As a matter of fact, it was at an exhibition of this China in Edinburgh that the poet Robert Burns attended. And this little sculptor explained this to him and said, do you realize, because he was French, you see, do you realize, Monsieur Burns, that had my family been good-looking, I would still be a peasant modeler in the factory. Now I am a rich man. Is that not lucky? And Burns then said, you know, this marvelous phrase, he said, well, ach, I the new hoots, because he was Scottish, you see. He said, well, it is so, the best laid schemes of Mason men gang aft ugly.
anybody dares to write a history of art with Frank Muir about, I don't know. We'll go on quickly to Dennis Norden. If you remember, his phrase was, your money or your life.
I had cause to mention before this sort of unease that I get in the presence of modern gadgetry and electrical appliances. All of them seem to go wrong for me while they work for everybody else. Bearing these facts in mind, it was perhaps a little foolhardy of me to answer this particular advertisement I saw in a paper. Have you ever heard of the computer dating service? I thought originally it was for some sort of scheme for people who want to have a date with a computer. But it isn't. It's a sort of a scheme whereby you send particulars of yourself to this office, and they're matched up on a computer, and in return they give you particulars of somebody whose characteristics are exactly the sort of thing that you're looking for. Well, I made inquiries about it, and it sounds very interesting. In fact, a bloke in my office met his wife through a computer dating service. They'd actually been married for 12 years, so it was a little embarrassing, but he said it was simply because he didn't fill the form up correctly. So I took great pains when I filled the form up, which again was a bit of an item for me, because form filling is another feature of modern life which gives me slight hot flushes. I mean, some those questions like, you know, where were you born and what did you do before that? and then it got to the age bit, you see, and I thought I was perfectly justified because they had this age and then it has this years, ...months, So I put down 29 years, 216 months. don't bother to work it out. But where I was most careful was where they ask you to state the type of opposite sex person that you want to meet. And I took a great deal of pains over that, because remembering the bad experience of this chap in my office, I put down the absolute ideal of the woman I'd really been searching for all my life. And I sent it off. And the arrangement was we met under the clock at Waterloo on the Saturday. And as soon as I saw her, well, it was uncanny. It was exactly what I had specified. And we had a marvellous evening. We had a small hors d'oeuvre at the corner house. And the sound of music, which we sat around twice. And then I took her home, and she said, would you like to come in for a bit, for a drink? And I said, yes. And then her husband came out of the bedroom. He was a bit sleepy, and he said, did you have a nice evening? And I said, yes, thanks, Dad. And while my mother put her apron on and went to make a cup of tea, I brooded on the fact that these computers take you so blooming literally. And the only conclusion I came to was that if you are about to use a computer dating service, it is all right for some. But if you're anything like that bloke in my office or myself, you'll wind up with, as Dick Turpin said, your mummy or your wife.
By your vote, the contest of the two stories is won by Dennis Norden. And he and Anne Scott-James do, in fact, win the entire contest this evening by 2.5 marks. And this brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Lillis Powell, Anne Scott-James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norton, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.
You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.